Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, it's been weird here in the Mojave Desert. I've been off for the past couple of weeks, off from my day job, that is, on TV, and just puttering around the house, catching up on some reading and writing. And outside, it has been so relentlessly gloomy. For the past 4 days, we haven't seen the sun, I don't think, maybe at all. Winds blowing constantly in heavy gusts up to like 30 miles an hour. And the sky kind of looks like a scene from one of those recent post-apocalyptic movies, The Road, if you saw that one, or The Book of Eli, this relentless high gray haze. I've even had calls from people wanting to know if these might be clouds of radiation floating over our country from Japan. And it sort of fits the mood, though, as if everything around us, everyone around us is coming apart at the seams, as if the train is rolling off the tracks. You got that triple header in Japan, the massive earthquake, the killer tsunami, the still unfolding potential China syndrome situation at the nuke plants there. Estimates in the media reports today say the death toll could be 20,000. I'm betting it's going to be higher than that, aren't you? And then you have something that almost took Japan off the front page, a nice brand spanking new war in the Middle East. One that we just couldn't stay out of. More than 100 American Tomahawk cruise missiles fired from U.S. warships at Libyan military installations the very first day. This Gaddafi character is a genuine nutball. And if he's got any WMDs, any weapons of mass destruction stashed in the desert somewhere, you got to figure that he's the kind of guy who would definitely use them. Especially if he thinks he's a dead man, which he almost certainly is. And here at home, inflation creeping up to go along with unemployment and deficits, foreclosures, stagnation, gas prices going crazy, as they always do whenever anything more serious than some Arab sheikh breaking wind in a tent or they find a mouse in a refinery somewhere, always a good reason to jack up oil prices. Uncertainty in the markets, they call it. And now it's food. We posted an article on the Coast to Coast website tonight outlining why higher food prices are not only here, but are probably here to stay. You know, we're spending billions of tax dollars going to grain-producing states to produce ethanol that does nothing to help our energy situation, might even be worse overall, but it's great news for big agribiz conglomerates. And the result is that corn prices are heading for the roof. So, you know, even if it isn't gloomy and cloudy in the skies where you are right now, I'd say there's plenty to be gloomy about. As always, webmaster Lex and I have put together a smattering of news stories from around the world, sort of a snapshot of the world at this moment. Among the stories listed there are two that I think are of relevance to tonight's program. One article is about the international weapons trade, the fact that India is now the biggest importer of weapons in the world. The U.S., of course, is far and away the biggest exporter of weapons. Nice to know we still make something that the world wants to buy, right? Also there is a piece about the high cost of nuclear weapons and what our country is prepared to spend over the next few years upgrading our nuclear arsenal, as if we could ever, under any circumstances, deploy them. I know it's all about deterrence. Stay strong so we never have to use them. That argument is sort of central to the discussion that we're going to be having the first 2 hours tonight. Journalist Bill Hartung has written a new book called Prophets of War. It was 50 years and 2 months ago that departing President Dwight Eisenhower issued his famous warning to the country in his farewell address to the nation. We have the original video posted on the website if you want to see it as the speech was delivered. And I think the words are chilling when you realize what has happened to our country in the decades since then. The warning was about the military-industrial complex and the threat that it poses to our basic liberties and our democratic system. And if anybody should know about that, it should be Ike Eisenhower, General Eisenhower. If you've ever wondered what happened to the military-industrial complex that Ike warned about, William Hartung says he knows exactly where it went. It is largely concentrated in a single mega conglomerate that has used threats, bribery, coercion, lies, and corrupt practices to keep the billions in government contracts rolling in. And there are consequences for all of us, not just financial consequences either. Bill Hartung will join us for the first 2 hours tonight to talk about issues that could not be more timely, especially of what's going on in Libya and Afghanistan and still Iraq and right here at home. In hours 3 and 4, we will switch gears. We'll learn about the consequences of belief systems. Rahasia Poe has written a new book. It's called To Believe or Not to Believe, which explores how we develop belief systems and how these beliefs can hold us back as a species, interfering with what he says is the evolution of our consciousness. It's heady stuff, so put on a pot, pull up a chair, and let's get ready to rumble. Time now for our first break. When we come back, Bill Hartung and the Prophets of War. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. William Hartung is the director of Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation, which is a project that serves as a resource for journalists, policymakers, and citizens' organizations on the issues of weapons proliferation, the economics of military spending, and alternative approaches to national security strategy. He's written for all of the major news organizations, Washington Post, LA Times, New York Times, and he's the author of numerous books, including his latest work, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Bill Hartung, glad to have you on the show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I read your book this weekend. It's just excellent. It's very well documented all the way through, very thorough, but not exactly real cheery. It occurred to me that the title could be Prophets of War, prophets being like the word for seers, or it could be Profits of War, as in dollars and cents. Either one seems to work just fine.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think there's kind of a connection between the two. I was sort of thinking about the way that the company at various points in its history has lobbied for war, which it then benefits from. And so I think that was kind of the reason for the kind of, double meaning.
I want you to give us a general premise of the book in a nutshell, but using this as the context for the premise. I want the audience to understand that your criticism is bipartisan, that involves basically every president since the Cold War, every Congress, not just Republicans or Democrats, but both major parties sharing the blame for what you're about to describe that's transpired, for allowing this one company and others to basically run amok.
Well, yes. The company started as a small operation. There were two brothers who worked out of a garage in San Francisco to build their first plane. And it went bankrupt a couple times in its early years. Didn't really get a traction until World War II. And this is sort of what Eisenhower talked about, how, there are times when we need defense industry to deal with threats, but that it's grown to the point where it affects not only our budget, but in some cases kind of the whole tenor of our democracy. And so a company like Lockheed Martin over the years has used, I think, as you mentioned, they've been involved in corrupt bargains, cost overruns, bribery of foreign officials, not bribery, but certainly influence peddling in terms of their influence on our own elected officials, and now kind of a growth into almost every area of our life. So not only do they work for the Pentagon, but they design nuclear weapons for the Department of Energy. They do work with the National Security Agency. Spy satellites. They work for the CIA. They work for the FBI, the IRS, the Census Bureau. So they've become kind of this all-purpose government contractor, which has access to all kinds of private information, intelligence information. They're kind of not only a weapons maker, but kind of a surveillance and information gathering company. So the question is, as Eisenhower questioned, how much power should one company or one set of companies have in the context of what's supposed to be free market democracy.
You have any theories on what Eisenhower, what prompted him to make that warning? Was there one event, or what did he see that led him to make those dramatic statements?
Well, there were a few things. One was the bomber lobby. There was a group of Air Force generals, Air Force personnel, contractor executives who wanted to build a new bomber, the B-70. Eisenhower felt we already had significant capability in that area, that there were other places to spend the money, both on defense and domestically, and also to keep the budget in balance with the rest of the economy. So he was very heavily lobbied, including by some of his own officials who sort of talked out of school. You know, they were supposed to be reporting to him, but they were lobbying for this bomber against his wishes. He also was offended by the early efforts of the companies to advertise their wares. You know, he felt like they were supposed to be basically taking their marching orders from decisions by the government about what we needed for security, but they were trying to kind of whip up interest by using advertising in, you know, not only specialty magazines like Aviation Week and Space Technology, but even major newspapers like the New York Times. And so that was another element of what he was concerned about. And then just he very much wanted to keep the budget on a somewhat even keel, and he was concerned that this push for more military spending was going to put it out of whack and therefore have a negative influence on our economy.
Well, the way you have described Lockheed and how it's operated over the last couple of decades, it sure sounds like it's exactly what he was warning us about.
I think, if anything, slightly more dangerous, just because larger than anything he could have imagined. The military budget is about twice what it was when Eisenhower was in office. And because the company is tapping into so many other areas of government spending, it's broader, it's got larger reach, larger tentacles, if you will, than the companies that he was dealing with back in his day.
I have to share with you my own impressions of Lockheed. When I think of Lockheed, I think of the Skunk Works, and you go into that amazing period in Lockheed's history. These guys, these scientists and engineers with slide rules, and they all get together in a building and create these amazing things. A lot of them were based right here in Nevada at Groom Lake, Area 51. The U-2, which, as you note in the book, came in under budget and ahead of time. The SR-71, which is my favorite plane of all time, the F-117, which has done a lot of good stuff. I mean, that company has done some tremendous things. So my general observation was fairly positive about Lockheed until I read this, and I would say it's spooky.
Well, I think you raise a good point in the sense that they have achieved some amazing feats in terms of technical aspects of some of their airplanes, which then gave us capabilities that no other country in the world had, be it stealth technology, be it the ability to monitor the Soviet Union with the U-2 spy plane. But at some point, I think it took a wrong turn, and it had to do with the just becoming kind of a money pit and really getting more involved in lobbying for government contracts than really producing weapons to the characteristics that the government needed. And I think that's sort of the area in which, we have to be the most concerned, is whether companies like Lockheed Martin and others are more interested in figuring out how to get money from the government than they are in making useful products.
Well, you always, Americans keep falling for this idea over and over about a peace dividend. You know, the Cold War ends, oh, great, we don't have to have this buildup against the Russians anymore. We can have a peace dividend. We can save that money. And the end of Vietnam War, we don't have to spend that anymore. Or if or when we ever get out of Afghanistan, and that's Afghanistan, and that's a big if, I guess. But it never seems to materialize. There's always some new threat out there, some new thing we got to spend a whole bunch of money on.
Well, yes, at the end of the Cold War, Colin Powell said, you know, I'm running out of enemies here. And you know, in part he meant no Soviet Union. In part he meant, how would you sustain a large military budget without somebody to point to as a need? And so their strategy turned to what they thought of as regional powers like Iraq and North Korea, which, of course, were dangerous to their people, dangerous to their regions, but didn't necessarily pose a direct threat to the United States at the time that this strategy was developed. And so, even given the need to perhaps deal with those countries, the military budget and the military industry was much larger than would be necessary to deal with that kind of threat. So there is an element, and even sometimes the companies are involved in coming up with studies, with arguments, with serving on government panels that talk about threats that are sometimes exaggerated, which then help feed the complex and feed not only the companies, but the bureaucracies in the Pentagon, which depend to some degree for their own size on a continuous sense of threat and also large inputs of government money.
Your book starts with what you could call Exhibit A, and that's the F-22, the Raptor. Where I live, I'm just a mile or so from Nellis Air Force Base. I would hear the Raptors fire up every morning, very loud, very cool planes, a lot of capabilities that have been described by the the Air Force, what they can do, and how superior they are to anything else in the world. The chapter you write about the Raptor, though, sort of incorporates all the trickery of the trade, all the kinds of things, the rabbits that Lockheed has pulled out of its hat to keep programs going, even when the Pentagon doesn't want them. Tell us that. Take a couple of minutes and tell us the story of the F-22 and what kind of tricks were pulled.
Well, there came a point, there were several points, but the most recent point when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, you know, we've got this plane, it may well be capable, but we don't really have a use for it. We're fighting two wars, and even with two wars, it's not being used. It's the most costly fighter plane that's ever been built. And although it's got significant capabilities, they're not capabilities that we necessarily need right now. But the company begged to differ, of course, because it was an important source of revenue for it. So one of the things it did was make the jobs argument. They put a series of ads in the Washington Post designed to some to be a veiled threat to members of Congress that if you vote against this, then we're going to point out that there's jobs in your state, be it in Connecticut, be it in Mississippi, be it in Chicago. You know, they mentioned 8 or 10 different companies and states in their ads that would have job loss if we didn't build the F-22. And one thing I found interesting is that they overstated the amount of jobs involved. They talked about 95,000 jobs. They made it sound like if this thing was ended, those jobs would disappear tomorrow. But in fact, I looked at sort of standard estimating procedures that are used to figure out how many jobs $1 billion in the industry would create, and it was more like 30 to 40,000, not 95,000. And it also appeared that a lot of the states that they mentioned had little or no activity. They claimed they were in 44 states. So this exaggeration helped, you know, sort of bolster the jobs argument. But in this case, you know, despite that, Congress eventually voted against it. And I think that was because of the arguments of Secretary Gates, the fact that it wasn't needed, the fact that there were other equipment that were more relevant to the wars that were being fought. But a couple interesting things happened. First of all, you know, we built 187 of these things when many times before they needed had been questioned. They had won the day with some of these same arguments about the jobs. But also they got a little sort of kicker, a little payoff at the end because the $4 billion that was reduced from the F-22 was increased for the F-35, another Lockheed Martin plane. So basically, they came out even on the deal, and now the F-35 itself has had cost overrun problems, performance problems. It's not clear we should be spending so much money so soon until the kinks are gotten out of the system. But in order to make the company happy and kind of reduce that lobbying pressure, this money was spent basically a way to, if not pay off, at least mute the criticism that the company would bring to bear on the government otherwise.
Why wouldn't they use them in Afghanistan or Iraq, just at least to pretend as if they were needed?
Well, in neither place were there, it's really designed to do aerial combat with other fighter planes. And so Al-Qaeda doesn't have an air force.
That's right.
Iraq's air force was taken out pretty early
in
the conflict. So there's plenty of other ways to drop bombs that are more efficient than using this plane. So it really was a case of the adversaries we had didn't really match up with the capabilities of this plane. And also, Secretary Gates pointed out that even current generation planes, if they continue to upgrade them, would give us about a 25-to-1 edge over China even 10 or 15 years from now in terms of sophisticated combat aircraft. So there didn't seem to be a present need. There didn't seem to be a future need. And it was, you know, soaking up money that might have been spent on things like, you know, training pilots, things like armored vehicles that might be used, you know, more effectively to protect troops in the field. And also to just look at whether spending $700 billion a year on the military, which is the largest level since World War II, was the most efficient and effective way to protect the country, whether there was some, you know, fat in the process that could be trimmed and make available either to cut the deficit or invest in other areas.
Isn't there a quote from Secretary Gates somewhere in your book where he says to either Lockheed or to Congress, hey, look, we spend more on defense than the rest of the world combined. A small little cut here or there is not going to make us vulnerable.
Yes, he did say that in a speech in Chicago before the vote on the F-22. And he also said, you know, given the amounts being spent, and in fact, the military budget, even without the F-22, continues to go up. He said, you know, given that we're spending more or close to more than the rest of the world combined, you know, only in the parallel universe of Washington, D.C. could people consider that, you know, gutting defense, which was coming, argument coming from a lot of members who had defense industries in their district. And so we're really defending more of a parochial pork barrel interest than a national security interest.
Bill Hartung, author of the new book, Prophets of War. When we come back, I want to get into the idea of Congress as a willing and able partner in keeping this whole charade going. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast. Allman Brothers taking us into the break. We're talking with Bill Hartung, author of the new book, Prophets of War. The example we were discussing, the F-22, is a telling one. I mean, Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Defense says, I don't need these planes. We don't want to build them. We don't want to spend the money. We'd be better off getting something else, putting the money into another plane, the F-35. He calls the head of Lockheed Martin onto the carpet and says, if you continue this pressure campaign where you're advertising and twisting arms in Congress, I'll bury you. So Lockheed Martin backs off. The Pentagon doesn't want it. Lockheed Martin is not pushing for it. And still, it almost passed in Congress. How does this one company get that kind of influence in Congress? We'll get into that topic when our conversation continues in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Bill Hartung about Lockheed Martin and whether or not it is the military, it has morphed into sort of the military-industrial complex that Ike Eisenhower warned us about. Bill, I don't know if you heard the tease or not, but in the break I was telling the audience how odd it seems to me, as you describe in the book, that there's the Secretary of Defense Gates saying we don't want this thing, it's too expensive, the F-22, it would probably hurt us in other ways, there's cheaper and better ways, better for our security to do this. Let's don't do it. He calls in the head of Lockheed Martin, says, don't be fighting me on this or else. Lockheed Martin backs off, and still this thing almost passed in Congress.
Well, yes, there are members who are kind of on board. You know, even before Gates made his formal announcement about cutting the plane, Lockheed Martin generated a letter from 44 members of the Senate and 200 members of the House of Representatives saying, you know, we need this thing. You know, for defense, but really we need it for the economy. It's a recession, not the time to be cutting government spending. You know, there's jobs in our states involved. You don't want to be the one who's, you know, sort of tarred with the idea that you've, stopped economic activity in the middle of this recession. So they already had this sort of army of, you know, better than lobbyists, but members of Congress themselves going to bat for them. And so people like Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut, where the engine was built, Senator Saxby Chambliss from Georgia, where the plane was assembled. They had the Texas delegation because there was some work being done there. So all the sort of major assembly points were the same people who were lobbying in Congress, along with people like the Machinists Union, who were involved in some of the production. And so, of course, had issues about jobs for their members. So, you know, it was a true dilemma, you know, given that the economy was not going so well. But the defense budget should not be a jobs program. It really should be about what we need to protect the country. And that was sort of the distortion that was introduced into the process, was this, you know, jobs. We got to keep it for jobs, which, of course, pretty much anything you do with the money will create some sort of jobs, including a tax cut. So it was kind of to some degree, a misleading argument.
Is there a case to be made that when it comes to government spending, that defense spending is one of the least productive ways to create jobs as compared to, say, some kind of domestic spending or, as you mentioned, a tax cut?
Well, for things like education or mass transit, there's about 2 times as many jobs per $1 billion spent. Things like infrastructure investment or weatherizing homes or alternative energy, about 1.5 times. And then a tax cut, about 20% more jobs per $1 billion if you were to, instead of spending it on the plane, just cut taxes. So it's about the least efficient way available to create jobs, which also undermines a bit the argument of the company that, you know, this is going to be a disaster for the economy, and really it would probably be a net gain in terms of overall jobs.
You know, again, to emphasize the bipartisan nature of this influence that Lockheed Martin has, I mean, you had people like John Kerry and Ted Kennedy voting for the F-22, again, because of the jobs in Massachusetts. You know, they're not exactly hawks on defense. And John McCain, probably more important than anyone in stopping the thing, he's not exactly a panty waist when it comes to defense.
No, in fact, this was one of the few cases where McCain and President Obama agreed. You know, they haven't really worked together on too many other issues, but both of them felt like this was a boondoggle. It wasn't needed to defend the country. McCain had a little bit of freedom because it was not majorly produced in his state, whereas people like Barbara Boxer from California, Patty Murray from the state of Washington, other prominent Democrats voted for it, you know, as did Kennedy and Kerry, because of the jobs question.
Tell me, just walk us through it. How does a company like Lockheed Martin get this kind of influence on both sides of the aisle in Congress? I mean, you had Daniel Inouye, who, you know, is known for bringing home the bacon to Hawaii. He gets up and says, there are, you know, there's no jobs in Hawaii. I'm just voting for this sheerly on the issue of national security, which is a bunch of baloney. But what are the tools that Lockheed Martin uses to ingrain itself with Congress, other than, I guess, taking out ads in the home state of the senator or representative and talking about jobs?
Well, they're a big campaign contributor. They're in a way's biggest contributor. Buck McKeon is the new head of the House Armed Services Committee. They're his biggest contributor. They spend about $12 million every cycle on either lobbying or campaign funding, which is the biggest within the defense industry. They hire people who have had important jobs in the government who can then help them put influence back on their former colleagues. For example, the head of procurement in the Pentagon, who had helped keep the F-22 afloat for many years, the day he retired, went immediately to work on Lockheed Martin's board. They also had people go into the government to do things like be in charge of military space procurement, be in charge of the nuclear weapons complex, work on the National Security Council staff, be in charge of promoting weapons exports to Latin America, where they've had some big sales. So they've become intertwined with the government in many ways. So not only does it affect the Congress, but it also gives them influence with the executive branch. And then finally, they've even worked with think tanks that have promoted systems that they have a stake in and help finance them. So it gives the impression that there's these sort of objective analysts, when in fact they're influenced to some degree by getting money from the company.
Describe for me the kinds of, now you stop short of calling it bribery, I guess, of members of Congress, although I guess, you know, a lot of people would say that the big money they give in campaign contributions could be seen that way. But you do call it bribery, and how the company has operated in other nations around the world, regardless of what international law or U.S. law says about these kind of techniques. Give us some examples of that. You describe them in detail in the book.
Well, in the early 70s, Lockheed Martin went for a government bailout because they had messed up a major transport plane, the C-5, and had to eat some of the cost overruns. And then their commercial airliner, the L-1011, was running at a deficit. So they got the loan guarantees, but in order to pay them back, they needed big sales, and they needed them quickly. So they were involved, for example, in an operation in Japan where they sent one of their vice presidents. And within a few days of getting there, first of all, he was working with a former alleged organized crime figure who had served time as a war criminal, who, when he was released, managed to get influence with not only the Japanese government but Japanese airlines. He was the conduit for bribes of $1.7 million for the prime minister, another $1.7 million for another key government official, payments to the airline executives, payments to members of the parliament. And so basically they spent in the range of $10 to $12 million in bribes. President Nixon spoke up on their behalf, as did the prime minister of the UK, which made the engines for the L-1011. They did similar things in the Netherlands, where Prince Bernhard was the conduit. They did things in Italy where they gave so much money that they couldn't track down which prime minister was getting it because there were several changes in government during the period when Lockheed Martin was paying the money. They did it in Indonesia. They did it in Saudi Arabia. So it became, in the 70s, kind of a routine way of doing business. And there's more sophisticated ways to exert influence over a foreign government. But this was basically just, you know, cash, just sort of straight-out bribery.
You mentioned Saudi Arabia, and that sort of struck a chord with me because Adnan Khashoggi was their point person over there. And the dollar amounts you cite, even though there were millions spent in Japan, it paled what was done in Saudi Arabia, which bought all kinds of U.S. hardware, right? And this guy was sort of the one carrying the ball for him.
Well, he had originally, his father had been a physician to the royal family, and that helped him at a very young age get connections throughout the royal family. And then he used those connections to basically say, if you want to do business here, you got to float us some money. And so he became the middleman. He made huge amounts of money himself, millions of dollars, and then additional millions to pass along for the bribes. And so every time there was a big deal, he would get a percentage, and he was actually arguing with them, should it be 2%, should it be 3%, should it be 8%? So there was constant haggling about how much the bribes and how much the fees for Khashoggi should be. But given that the Saudis, especially after the oil crisis, had huge amounts of money to spend and spent a lot of it on U.S. and European weaponry, there was just a regular flow of money to the Saudi regime, skimmed off the top of these various arms deals.
Would this kind of behavior be considered illegal here? Is it in the U.S. for a company based here to be doing this abroad?
Well, it finally was, at the time, it was not considered illegal. In fact, companies were writing it off on their taxes, the cost of the bribes, which is quite amazing. But then, as a result of these activities, in the 70s, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed, which outlawed this kind of direct bribery. And so it really was a question of would the companies get caught? And could they find other ways to exert influence that didn't involve, straight writing a check, providing cash?
Talk to me about what we get for the money. As I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, the U2 was a great example for the company. They did it under budget and ahead of schedule, and it was a fabulous success. But it seems like for every U2, there's a whole bunch of examples where things did not come in under a budget. In fact, quite the opposite.
Well, the biggest initial problem was the C-5 aircraft, which was the largest aircraft ever to be built up to that point. It could just about fit in a football stadium. If you stood under it, the nose of the plane would be 6 or 7 stories above you. It had a power train that could be, enough electricity to power a city of 50,000 people. So it was an amazing plane, but basically very early on, they had big cost overruns, which the Air Force tried to cover up. And it was only when a whistleblower named Ernie Fitzgerald within the Air Force pushed the issue that it became public knowledge that they had run a $2 billion cost overrun on the plane, which also had serious performance problems, like the wings kept cracking. And in fact, they had some crashes that, tragic crashes that where people actually died as a result. They also had the Cheyenne helicopter in the 60s, which cost about 3 times what they promised and was eventually canceled, but only after wasting, hundreds of millions of dollars of tax money. More recently, for example, they were supposed to build a series of ships for the Coast Guard, and there were 3 different varieties, kind of a small, medium, and large, and each of them had so many problems that they were not even seaworthy. And after spending billions of dollars, the Coast Guard had to go back to the drawing board and sort of start from scratch, building a new, more reliable design that was not promoted by Lockheed Martin and its partner, Northrop Grumman. So, there's been a lot of, overruns, sometimes corruption and how these things were covered up. And then, of course, the use of the influence of Congress to keep them going longer than they should have. So, I'd say probably on balance, probably more of these negative examples than the positive ones, although, there certainly were other positives. For example, they were the first one to build submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which also came in, close to cost. And, as far as we know, as a workable system, thankfully, they've never had to be used.
Well, what about successes then? What would you point to as their great successes that have allowed them to coast along regardless of failures? Maybe I'll ask it in this context. How do you get away with cost overruns like that? Huge, huge amounts of money over and over again without consequences. Doesn't somebody at some point say, you don't get any more contracts? You've screwed up the last 3 or 4 of them. Or, doesn't anyone look at a bid and say, all right, you bid for this, you got the low bid, But we know you're lying. We know you're just doing it to get the bid, and you're going to jack it up later.
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is collusion. For example, on the C-5, the Air Force knew it was a low bid, but they figured, once the thing got up ahead of steam, nobody in Congress was going to say, oh, we've spent $2 billion already, let's stop this thing. And in fact, some of the arguments to keep the plane going were precisely that. People like Senator Margaret Chase Smith said, we got to make the best out of this. We've already blown $2 billion on it. And, so the Air Force figured, well, if we come in low, Congress will, support this. And then later they'll have to support the cost overruns because we'll have them over a barrel. So partly there hasn't been, incentive or at least a history of the Air Force and the Pentagon driving a hard bargain with these companies. The other thing is the industry has become so concentrated now that a lot of times they have few choices. There's only one or two companies. For example, now there's just two companies that build fighter planes. There's Lockheed Martin, which builds everything for the Air Force, and soon will also be building everything for the Navy and the Marines as well with the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So, it's sort of like the adjective too big to fail. They're just in a position where they have very little other places to turn. So other than perhaps a fine here or there, or slowing down of a program, the government doesn't have substantial leverage because these companies are so large.
Well, talk to me for a moment about the consolidation, all this consolidation of these companies that took place in the 90s. I'm sure that they touted it as having, certain economies of scale and benefits to being so big, when in fact the opposite has happened. Now you're down to just, as you mentioned, like basically two.
Well, yes. There was in the Clinton administration, there was this notion that, you could save money by consolidating, that you'd have fewer empty factories, you'd lower the overhead. And in fact, Norman Augustine, who went on to head Lockheed Martin, engineered some of the first mergers. Martin Marietta, which he headed at the time, merged with Lockheed. They then bought the L'Oreal Corporation, a $10 billion operation. Overall, about 18 or 20 companies were merged together to make Lockheed Martin. And what happened was, the notion of, well, you're going to cut overhead and you're going to save money was overwhelmed by the fact that, there wasn't anywhere to turn. And so a lot of these systems, like the F-22, continued to go up, even as this overhead was basically the companies pocketed the savings from the overhead. And in fact, the government even gave them money to help pay for the mergers, even things like golden parachutes for executives whose positions had been affected by the mergers were subsidized with tax money as a result of lobbying by Augustine and others. So it, it turned into what was touted as a deal for the taxpayers, turned into kind of a nightmare in terms of the actual effects on how the tax dollars were spent.
There's a statistic that I think you use in the book. I'm trying to remember exactly. It's like $29 billion. And I don't remember what the percentage of all the money that the Pentagon spends each year on defense contracts, how much of that goes to Lockheed Martin?
Well, they get $29 billion a year in Pentagon contracts, some additional things for military-related items. And on the Pentagon side, they get about one out of every $14 the Pentagon spends on weapons. And their, spending of the $29 billion works out to about $260 a household, which I call the Lockheed Martin tax. You could just write them a check as easy as write it to the government because the money just passes through the government and goes straight to them.
So every household in America pays $260 a year to Lockheed Martin.
Just for that one company, which, the amount they get is larger than most government programs. It's twice as large as our State Department budget just for one company. So it's really an amazing sum. And as I said, much more than anything Eisenhower could have imagined for a single company.
And is there any company, is the second, we'll come back to that. The music's starting, so we're going to have to go to a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the prospects of whether or not Lockheed Martin has actually tried to push us into war and whether there's a limit on what they will sell. Will they sell anything to anyone, even enemies or potential enemies of the United States? Our conversation with Bill Hartung, authors of Prophets of War, continues on Coast to Coast AM.